Recognize Arkansas State Chairman, Mr. Baxter Sharp, for purposes of introduction. Baxter.
It is my pleasure to be here tonight to introduce our next speaker, the Honorable Bill Clinton, Governor of Arkansas. Governor Clinton received his bachelor's degree from Georgetown University, was a Rhodes Scholar at Oxford University, and earned his law degree from Yale University School of Law in 1973. In 1976, he was elected Attorney General of Arkansas, and in 1978 won his first term as governor at the age of 32. He is now serving in his fourth term in that capacity. Governor Clinton is the immediate past chairman of the National Governors Association and the Education Commission of the States, being the only governor to have chaired both simultaneously. In a 1986 Newsweek poll, Governor Clinton was selected by his fellow governors as one of the five most effective governors in the nation. And in an assessment of elected officials by U.S. News and World Report, he was included in an article entitled Top Performances of 1987. Governor Clinton is noted for developing one of the nation's most innovative health care programs for infants and children, for his role as a spokesman for governors on education and welfare reform, and for developing a teacher testing law. He considered running for presidency of the United States, but after careful deliberation decided against it in July, much to our delegation's dismay. Now he is considered to be a front runner for vice president, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see about that. Please join me in welcoming Governor Bill Clinton. Governor Clinton.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you very much, Baxter, Madam Chairperson, ladies and gentlemen. I want to tell you how glad I am to be here and that I have prepared for this speech over the last 8 years, having spoken at the last two National Democratic Conventions when the delegates didn't pay any more attention than some of you are. I enjoyed it very much anyway. It's nice to be at such a sedate, sober, restrained meeting. I want to say, in all seriousness, I came here tonight, even though it was a little bit difficult on my schedule, because I wanted to see how this convention would work, because I think it's so important for young people like you to get a feel for how the political system works. And it really is true, when we gather in Atlanta in July, the delegates will be rowdy, nobody will listen, and we'll all have a good time anyway. However, there is a sense in which you have a responsibility here that in some ways can go beyond the responsibility of ordinary delegates at the convention in July, because you are meeting first. And not only because you will be voting on candidates tomorrow, but because you will adopt a platform, and what you say and how you say it will be covered by others. And many people believe in particular that the young people of our country are not especially concerned about politics or the welfare of their fellow Americans, nor do they understand the gravity of this election. I believe they are wrong. I was honored to be asked to be the platform speaker because I believe that the most important thing we can do is to stand for something besides the election of our nominee, something besides the proposition that it's time to give it back to the Democrats, something besides the easy one-liners attacking the Reagan administration. They may be easy, but they are now irrelevant. That is over and behind us. And the issue is, what are we going to be for? I submit to you that this election will require us to produce, as a people, the president who can do two things of surpassing importance. The first is to literally create a new world economic system which will permit more growth in the world based on more trade, The second is to secure the place of the American people within it. Tonight I want to talk to you briefly about both of those things because they affect your future. Your future more than mine because you have more time left. Your future more than mine because you will be affected more deeply by the changes ahead of us. Your future more than mine because your children will grow up in a world very different from the one in which I grew up, where I took America's economic supremacy, its political supremacy, and its military supremacy for granted. From 1946, the year in which I was born, until about 15 years ago, this country dominated the world in every way. We did it because of our strong economy and because our allies in the war and our adversaries were destroyed. We were able to enjoy the kinds of progress and prosperity that others only dreamed of. But real wages in America peaked in 1973, and they've been going down ever since. It is time that we face the fact that we must live in a world we no longer dominate, but one in which we can still lead, one in which we had better lead if we want the American dream to stay alive for our own children and people throughout the world. In 1980, Ronald Reagan was elected at a time of great frustration for our people on a program of lowering interest rates and lowering inflation and lowering taxes and increasing defense spending and balancing the budget. And let's be fair to President Reagan. He did everything he said he'd do except balance the budget. He couldn't do that because supply-side economics defies arithmetic. But everything else he did, just as he promised. Unfortunately, what he did was not done for free. And when we doubled the debt of the country and more in 8 short years, we paid a terrible price for it. We became the world's biggest debtor nation from being the world's biggest creditor nation. And we had to have a very high dollar so we could attract foreign money to pay off our own debts, with the consequence that we taxed our own exports and subsidized imports into this country. And in the middle of America today, there are people who used to farm who don't, people who used to have factory jobs who don't, people who used to drill for oil and mine for minerals who can't, because of the collapse of the production sector in this country, because of the decisions which were made. And I say to you, the most important thing that we can do is to build a new world economic system that is in balance, that permits growth, that enables every single American who wants to work to do it, and to do it with dignity and with success. That has got to be our program. In order to do that, we must reduce the deficit every year for the next 5 years, even if it requires us to have the dirty little word TAX as part of our program. We have got to do it. In order to do that, we must have help in promoting world economic growth from the Europeans and the Japanese. I am so sick and tired of getting lectures from Europe and Japan about how terrible our deficit is. They got rich of it in the 1980s, and they need to help us promote economic growth in the 1990s. If we want a growing American economy in a growing world, we must do something about the debt of our neighbors in Latin America. This administration has been obsessed with what goes on in Nicaragua, but paid scant attention to what goes on in Brazil and Mexico and Venezuela and all those countries that are burdened down with debt and cannot grow. Last year, if the growth rates in Latin America last year had been what they were in 1978 and 1979, our trade deficit would have been 20% lower than it was. Hundreds of thousands of Americans would have been working. We cannot have world growth with all of our partners in the Southern Hemisphere burdened down by debt they will never be able to pay. We must do something about it, and the President has to take the lead. And finally, we have got to have a new set of trade rules in the world. The issue is not whether you're a protectionist or for free trade. Everybody knows that protectionism means more poverty abroad and declining incomes at home. But everybody should know that very few countries in the world today are prepared to practice free trade. Very few. So what America has to do is to get with our allies and say, look, we've got one of two choices. We're either going to have a new set of trade rules, which encompass most of the trade in the world and which will be fair to everybody, or we're going to have to go out and make more deals like we just did with Canada to permit open trade between two countries. We cannot continue to be taken advantage of by people who will not practice what they preach, and we have to practice what we preach. And we must expect our economic and political allies to be our military allies as well. This year we will spend $150 billion defending Europe. $150 billion. Defending a continent with a gross national product larger than ours, where every single country spends a smaller percentage of their income on defense than we do, even though their per capita incomes are almost the equal of ours. I submit to you that we should continue to defend Europe, but they should pay more of the bill. They should pay more of the bill. They have the same ability to pay that we do, and it is wrong. It is wrong for us to spend $150 billion on them with their incomes as high as ours, so that they can take the $150 billion that they didn't have to spend and educate their children and give their working people child care and take care of their health needs and invest in equipment and plant and modernize their economy to beat us in world economic competition. It is wrong. It is wrong. But let me say something else. Even if we create the most rational, the most effective, the most growth-oriented economic partnership you can imagine, even if the world economy begins to make more sense in the next couple of years, this country could still continue to have income declines. We still might not become what we ought to be. And why? Because of all the advanced economies in the world, we waste more money, more resources, and more people than any country with which we are in competition. We squander our God-given resources at record rates. We have no economic policy in this country to revive the inner cities. We have no economic policy in this country to help the depressed areas in the Mississippi Delta from Memphis to New Orleans, where I live, the poorest place in the country. We have no economic policy that requires research and development in non-defense areas to be equal to that of our strongest competitors and to spread it throughout the country so that people can benefit it from everywhere. And we must do those things, because if we don't, we'll be punished for the waste and our resources. Most important of all, we have got to do a better job of developing all our people. You look around this room today, nearly every delegate to this convention comes from a family where he or she grew up without want, comes from a family where you were encouraged to get a decent education, comes from a family where you could go home at night without fear of being mugged or shot at on the way home from school, comes from a community where people supported your deepest and strongest aspirations, but too many of our fellow citizens do not. Do you know that a child born in the nation's capital today has a worse chance of living to be a year old than a child born in Costa Rica? And we can never tolerate the continuation of that condition and expect America to be what it ought to be. Why? Why? Because by 1995, we'll have a labor shortage in this country. All the baby boomers like me will be in the workforce. The percentage of women going into the workforce will not continue to increase. And if we continue to waste people at the rate we're wasting them, we will not be able to compete in a world economy, even though we have a labor shortage, because we are squandering our most precious resources, our people. And so I tell you, you can say whatever you want to say about economics. We must go from 17th to 1st in our infant mortality rate. We must go from 18th to 1st in the percentage of our babies born with low birth weight. We cannot have these kids showing up for kindergarten not being able to know their colors and their shapes and their numbers and spell their first names just because America neglected them. It's wrong. And we know what to do about it, and we ought to do it. Just a few months ago, the Committee for Economic Development, a bipartisan group of corporate executives in New York, most of whom voted for Ronald Reagan both times, said the biggest economic threat to the future of this country is the fact that 25% of the kids under five in America are living below the poverty line and are going to grow up not being able to be productive citizens. And the Democratic Party ought to do something about it, because we can, and it's cheap. It doesn't cost much money to bring a child in the world healthy. It doesn't cost much money to give a child from a very difficult background appropriate preschool opportunities. But the Head Start program today, which is a proven success, only covers 18% of the eligible kids in America, because we're too tight to pay for it while we subsidize other people out the ears. It's wrong, and we need to turn it around. Most important of all, we have to make sure every American gets a good education from cradle to grave. Education is no longer the province of youth. The average 18-year-old in the workforce today will change jobs 7 times in a lifetime. Therefore, it is not so important what you know, but what you are capable of learning. And America, again, falls short. We fall short for several reasons. Number one, our high school graduates, when they graduate, on average have had 2 or 3 years less time learning than our competitors in Europe and Japan. What does that mean? What does that mean? It means that we're not going to catch up, at least those of us who aren't going on to college. You, who are here at this institution, represent half of the people your age. Let me tell you what's happening to the other half. According to the Grant Commission, which is studying the move from school to work, of those who graduate from high school and go to work, or those who drop out of high school and go to work, between 1973 and 1986, real average wages for all American workers dropped 17%. Between 1973 and 1986, average wages for young men between 20 and 24 who are just high school graduates dropped 28%. And during that same time period for young men between 20 and 24 who dropped out of high school, people that you may not identify with, may not know, and may never think about, their wages dropped 42%. And we cannot preserve the American dream if we continue to let that happen. Between 1981 and 1986, for the first time in my lifetime, 40% of the American people had an increase in their income, 20% held steady, and 40% had a decline. And you think of this. In this fine college, coming from the backgrounds that most of you come from, you think of this. Can America preserve the American dream if 5, 10, 15 years from now, 40% of the people are still going up and 40% of the people are still going down? You know we can't. We have got to turn it around, and education is the only way to do it. Almost 100% of the people who are in that lower 40% whose incomes have declined are people who did not have a decent education. We can't have a 25% dropout rate from high school and expect to do well. We can't have only 50% of our high school graduates going on to college when our competitors have a 2-year advantage on us at the end of high school. We have to have 80% going on. And therefore, I make this specific suggestion for the Democratic Party. Instead of doing what President Reagan wanted to do and cutting back on student loans and scholarships, we should dramatically increase them until we increase by 50% the number of our young people going beyond high school, getting more education, so we can catch up. But I do not think that the increase should be for free, because there's another group of Americans about whom you ought to be concerned. The people who are already in the workforce, the people who are laboring to support you, the people who have done everything they could to be good citizens, but themselves have no education. We have one of the highest rates of illiteracy among adult working people of any country with which we compete, and 80% of the people who will be in the workforce in the year 2000 are there tonight. 80% of the people who will be working when the century turns are there tonight. That means no matter what we do for people your age and younger, when the century turns, much of the workforce will be determined by the education and training efforts that are made on the people who are there right now. So I submit to you that when we increase scholarships and loans for young people, to increase the number of them who can have an education like you're getting, we ought to make a condition of that, that they be willing to be public servants, to learn to be trained as literacy instructors, and to go into the cities and country all across America to teach adults in the workforce to read in return for the college education that they are getting. Finally, the Democrats have an obligation to increase the security of the American people, not only abroad, but at home. There has been a lot of rhetoric in the last 8 years about fighting drugs, but precious little action. The administration has quadrupled dollars available for enforcement in the drug war, but reduced in real terms dollars available for treatment. The Democratic Party should come out with a comprehensive plan to enforce security in the inner city of this country and to get serious about fighting the drug problem. And here is what we should do. First of all, people ought to be able to get treatment on demand anywhere in this country if they're trying to get off drugs. Secondly, we ought to continue the fight that the administration and the First Lady have fought well to get people to just say no. In the end, we can never cure our own sickness by beating our enemies. We have to do it from within. Until our culture says we will not do this anymore, there will always be a market for drugs somewhere by somebody. We have got to convince the American people deep down in the marrow of their bones they have to stop doing this. We have got to do it. The third thing we need to do is to guarantee the security of the American people who live in places where the drug wars are running rampant. In Los Angeles County alone, there are over 60 gangs peddling crack and violence at the same time. In Detroit, the largest gang of people peddling crack were poor black young people who came from the Mississippi Delta in my home state, where the unemployment rate for people their age was 65%. We have got to turn that around. But in the meanwhile, we have to bring security to the inner city. You cannot let kids walk down streets home from school and be shot at the way they are. Live in housing projects when they can be brutalized. Whatever it takes, we have to put the money into the places where the troubles are to make places safe in this country. It is wrong to have people in America living in mortal fear when they're in the most formative years of their lives. And we have got to step up the ability to reduce the amount of drugs coming into this country. In the Reagan administration, we have gone from 2 tons to 27 tons of cocaine being intercepted. We ought to be able to go to 200. But we have to treat it like a threat to our national security, because it is. We have to use every available natural resource, every available body. We ought to train people who are available to interdict the drug supply to do it. And finally, and most important, we should cooperate with other countries who have the same problem we do to form a United Nations peacekeeping effort to go into the countries which are producing the drugs that are killing our people and eating the heart out of the spirit of many of our cities, and go after those people. But we cannot do it alone. If America does it alone, we'll be said, oh, there are the ugly Americans. But if we do it in cooperation with other countries, we can do it, and we should. We should. And another thing we ought to do is quit doing business with drug runners like Noriega. We have got to stop it. How can our credibility be preserved if we say one thing and do another? Let me say this in closing. I believe the ability of the Democratic Party to change the course of America's future rests on our acceptance of two simple ideas. The first is that we're all in this together. And you have to ask yourself if you believe that. I believe that the future of the most successful defense contractor in Connecticut is bound up with the busted farmers in Iowa. I believe that the future of the richest stockbroker on Wall Street is bound up with the poorest black school child in the Mississippi Delta. I believe that we are going to rise and fall together, because if we can't prove that our people can compete with others across the board, we're going to get beat no matter what kind of economic policies we have. And if you believe that, we're going to be all right. You have to ask yourself if you do. I was raised till I was four by my grandparents. My grandfather had a sixth grade education, but he taught me to read and to count before I went to kindergarten because he said, you have to learn. You have to get an education so you'll do better than we did. And a lot of the adults here tonight, I see them nodding their head. We were raised that you got to get an education so you'll do better than we did. You know what? I want you to get a good education, not just so you'll do better than I did, because I'm not going to do very well if you don't get a good education. My future is bound up in yours, but also in the 50% of your fellow Americans who are your age who are not here or in any other college tonight. And I plead with you to believe that your interest is bound to theirs. And the second thing I ask you to believe is this, that at critical junctures in a nation's history, what happens to it depends solely on whether enough people are committed to pay the price to achieve the future. 20 years ago this summer, I graduated from Georgetown University. Two days after the man I supported for president, Robert Kennedy, was shot dead in Los Angeles. One of my roommates worked in his office, and I can tell you that that was the saddest time for millions of young people in this country, because he believed that even though he was very wealthy, his future was bound up with the poorest people who farmed the land in California or who lived in the deepest ghetto in every city in this country. And he believed that we could do better. And when he died, a great part of what many people hoped for the Democratic Party died too. 20 years later, we are being called upon to meet a whole different set of challenges by people who hope but are not sure we can get the kind of commitment to the future we need. And so I will close with a reminiscence from my own college days. When I was a freshman in college, I had a professor of Western civilization who gave some of the most memorable lectures I ever heard, and I remember some of them almost verbatim. The last lecture was about what was special about America, what was special about Western civilization. And here is what he said. He said, our civilization has taken more people further out of ignorance and depravity and need than any other one because of the simple belief that the future can be better than the present and that every person has a personal moral responsibility to make it so. And he looked out at us and he said, and I might say today, he looked at us and he said, you know, tuition at Georgetown is pretty high. You all are here because your parents prefer your future to their present. And as long as this country has people who prefer their children's future to their present, we're going to be all right. But if we ever reach the point when we don't, we're through. And don't you ever forget it. For 8 long years, as we have gone deeper and deeper into debt, as we have ignored the educational needs, the investment needs of our country, we have acted as if we could mortgage the future to consume in the present, and we're in trouble. But we're in nowhere near the trouble we were in the Civil War, after which Mr. Lee came here and founded one of the great universities of our time. Nowhere near in as much trouble as we were in the Great Depression, out of which President Roosevelt led us by reminding us that the only thing we had to fear was fear itself. This is not a time like that, but it is a time when we could sacrifice the leadership that Americans have fought and bled and died for 200 years simply because we did not understand that we're all in this together and we're going up or down together, and that the only way to do what we need to do is to pay the price for the future. We owe that to our past, and we owe that to our children. And if the Democratic Party stands for that in its platform, we'll ride home to the White House in November. Thank you, and God bless you all.